Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for The Christophers, and on today's show, I'll be joined by one of the world's all-time best-selling authors, Dean Koontz. Dean and I will be chatting about the supernatural foundation of all his suspense novels, the spiritually transcendent power of art, seeing the sacred in our everyday lives, and of course, his latest novels, which include The City, Innocence, and the Odd Thomas series. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi, and my guest today is Dean Koontz. With 450 million copies of his books sold worldwide, and 14 novels that have reached number one on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list, Dean Koontz is one of our most successful authors. I think the reason for that success is because his novels are grounded in an unwavering sense of hope. That might seem a strange way to describe an author whose stories often include horrific crimes and even the presence of demons. But Dean knows there's a higher power at work in the universe that will keep those forces of evil from achieving ultimate victory, even if they win the occasional battle. That holds true in his latest books, which include The City, Innocence, and the Odd Thomas series. Joining me now to talk about his life, his work, and his vision of the world, I'm pleased to welcome to Christopher Close-Up, Dean Koontz. Dean, thanks so much for being on the show once again.
Well, thanks for having me there.
Now, what I've read in another interview with you, this novel, The City, seems to have come to you as something of a gift from above for those of us who believe in those things. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of The City and the story of young Jonah Kirk.
Well, these days, when a novel is coming out, the publisher likes you to do what is called an e-single or an e-book that's of a novelette length or short story so that it can pre-sell the coming hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down to write. The hardcover at that time was Innocence, which is set in a prototypical city of my creation. And I sat down to write another story set in that same city. That would be the only link between the story and the novel. And after I got to about page 50, telling Jonah Kirk's story, I realized this wasn't going to be a short story or novelette. It was going to be a novel and perhaps even a kind of lengthy one. And I have no idea where this came from. I mean, it's one of the great things about this is there are projects that you do know where they came from. You were in a car. I was in a car once listening to music, and it was in my wife's car, and she had old Simon and Garfunkel albums on, and this song came up called Patterns. And there was a line in it, and I got the entire novel Life Expectancy from that line. But
wow.
In some cases, you just have no clue where this comes from. And those are the moments where you think it's the activity of grace in your life, and you just stop thinking about it and let it come. Let it flow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a one-page prelude to The City, and there's a conversation between the characters of Malcolm and Jonah about the balance of light and dark in the world. And I was really reminded of this Christopher idea of lighting a candle instead of cursing the darkness. In a world where bad news seems to dominate, how do you keep from being overwhelmed by the darkness as a person and as a writer? Because all your novels are ultimately hopeful.
I think in some ways it goes back to childhood, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but because I had an unpleasant childhood, and I've spoken somewhat about it, I had a violent alcoholic father who was a gambler and a womanizer, and we were very poor as a consequence of it. My mother was a great person, but she suffered quite a lot and seemed dominated by his chaotic personality, and people tend to think that I was therefore had an unhappy childhood. And I said, no, when I look back on it, I always could find something to make me happy. It was books, which I could escape into. An uncle got me a bicycle at one point for Christmas. And after that, I could hop on that bike and go anywhere in our small town and be away and having fun. And I think you either make a choice in life at a point, and I think you can do this at any point in life, mm-hmm. not to do it young, that, look, bad things happen to good people, as they say,
right.
And bad things happen to bad people, too. And you can just, you can either be embittered by it, become overwhelmed by it, or you can find the beauty in life, which is at all times all around you. And that's sort of in The City what Jonah Kirk, that's his strength, I think, is has a lot of good things in his life, but some really terrible things happen in the course of his life and the course of his childhood. And as a consequence of that, he could give up or he could look around for what's beautiful and emphasize that in his life. And that's what he does.
Right. Well, do you think seeing that early example of seeing, say, the light in your mother and the darkness in your father, because those themes work their way into pretty much all of your work. Do you think that really set your course as a writer?
I think I do. In fact, the worst thing about my life under my father was not so much the poverty, which we never knew if we were going to have a roof over our heads the next day or food on the table, but it was a small town. And as a consequence, when everybody knows who your father is and what he does, you're subject to almost constant humiliation or embarrassment, and you grow up with that. And so there's a temptation for a long time in your life to think at times how much better my life would have been or how much more I would have maybe achieved if I'd had a rosier childhood. But then there are moments when I think, no, if I hadn't had my dad's example, I might have gone that way. But I could see what life was like if you led it that way, and it wasn't anything good. And so it became an example of what not to do, and my mother became the example of what to do. And I think, yes, that is where I was able to clearly see that there is good and evil in the world, and there are not just shades of gray. And a lot of people struggle all their lives thinking there's shades of gray and nothing else. And as a consequence, I think it helped me a great deal as a writer to have grown up in that environment.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to Dean Koontz about his novel, The City. You just mentioned growing up in a small town. And I noticed in this, the community that Jonah is growing up in, at least his immediate circle of friends and family. I mean, this takes place in the 1960s, so there's a lot of turmoil in the world. But for Jonah's circle of friends and family, it almost seems like they're living out Dr. Martin Luther King's dream of judging people by the content of the character instead of the color of their skin. Is that based in some kind of a real experience for you, or was that just a kind of you creating the world the way you wish it were?
Well, it's the idea of family here, and a family functioning in the right way is really key in this story. Mm-hmm. And it's central to it is the relationship of mother and son. And this is a little off your question, but I think it's interesting. At least it is to me. Mm-hmm. I wrote this whole book, and Jonah is black, and I'm white, and Jonah is a musician, a prodigy, actually, and my gift is with language. So we're not the same character, but in some ways we are very much alike. Mm-hmm. And his mother is certainly very like my mother. My mother was not a singer or would want to be a singer or anything like that, but the relationship between the two of them is there. Now, I have to tell you, the other thing that sometimes people would say, well, you're deluding yourself, you're writing unconsciously, you're trying to avoid thinking what you're writing about consciously. Well, I would say, no, it was just a grace that came to me, because when the book was finished, I gave it to my wife, and she read it and came in with tears in her eyes and said, this is the best thing you've ever done. Mm-hmm. And she didn't want me to change a word, but my editor did want a couple of things, and one I couldn't agree to, but the other I could. Mm-hmm. And my wife said, no, don't do the other. I don't want to see anything change. And it was just an additional two-page scene, so I wrote it. I thought it worked really well. It was a good editorial suggestion. And I took it into the kitchen. We were just about to start getting dinner together. And I started trying to read it to Gerda. And I kept getting verklempt. I could not read this two pages. And finally, I had to leave the room and collect myself. And I came back and struggled through it. I read it then, but kept tearing up. And when I finished reading it to her, she loved the scene, but I said, I don't know why I've been so emotional about this book. But the whole way through, as I sat here, I would come to tears at times writing certain scenes. And she looked at me with this amazement and said, well, of course, because it's about you and your mother's relationship. Mm. And I did not see that the entire way through the book. Now, some people would say, okay, it's a psychological mechanism. I think this came as a grace. The idea came to me in a form that I could be distant enough from it to write about it without too much sticky sentimentality and try to keep it real.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons I find writing fascinating, because you are in touch with some other creativity at times that seems not to be yours and seems to be much, much more complex and interesting than my creativity.
Right, right. Well, at one point in the story, Jonah says about his mother, Sylvia, she always made me feel like more and better than I knew myself to be. Like you're saying, this writing this story was a grace, but was that something your mother did for you too when you were growing up?
Yeah, that certainly is something that happened. It was a close relationship in a sense, and then it was not a close relationship in some other senses, because my mother couldn't bear, we lived in a very small house, it was next thing to a shack with a tar papal roof. We didn't have any indoor plumbing until I was 11. And the fights that would take place, or my father coming home drunk, she would always send me to my room, but the walls were all but paper. But she convinced herself in some way that I was kept apart from some of the worst things that happened. And in fact, I was in the same house, so I was aware of everything.
Yeah.
But I think there had to be between us this little bit of a fiction that a lot of this was things I was not aware of, but in fact I was.
Right, right. I'm talking to Dean Kuntz about his novel, The City. We were talking before a lot about good and evil, and you write about people choosing evil a lot. And it seems sometimes it stems from something bad that happened in their past, like you say about Jonah's father, Tilton, in the book. But on the other hand, some people deal with adversity and still emerge better, more compassionate people. What do you think makes the difference? Why do some people break bad, so to speak, while others become better?
I think it does come back to believing in something bigger than us.
Okay.
If you find that very difficult, then you fall into nihilism, essentially, and it doesn't matter then it does matter, but to you think it doesn't matter what you do. The world is just a chaotic place and nothing has any meaning. But I think if you're aware that there are things do have meaning and the evidence is everywhere around you, I don't think, in fact, you have to be religious in the sense of a churchgoer and be a member of a particular creed. I think you can look around the world without having been raised that way and with your eyes wide open, and mm-hmm. you will see almost daily in your life so many strangenesses, so many mysteries. The older I get, the more I see it. The older I get, the more I say, how does anybody not believe?
Yeah.
It's the easiest thing in the world to look around and say, wow. And I read a lot of science, and contrary to what most people believe, the more that we learn through quantum mechanics, the more we learn through molecular biology, the more complex, layered, and mysterious the world gets. Yes, we learn more about how it functions, but we don't learn the essence of why. And I think that why is something you see or you don't see, but I think you can open yourself to it. You have to open your heart and mind to it. And then you do see it, and it starts to come to you in so many amazing ways.
Right, right. There's a quote from St. Gregory of Nyssa, ideas lead to idols, only wonder leads to knowing. So you are a proponent of wonder, right?
Oh, absolutely. My novels make that really, I think, perfectly clear. It's and that's something that's been with me since I was a kid, this sense of wonder about the world. And it only grows richer for me the older I get. It's I'm grateful for getting older, because so far there actually has been a little more wisdom than I had as a child.
I'm Tony Rossi, and you're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'll be back in a minute to continue my conversation with Dean Kuntz, but first here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
Every once in a while, we come face to face with someone who has borne the weight of the world on their shoulders without losing hope or crumbling under the pressure. How are some people able to cope in circumstances that would debilitate the rest of us? The short answer is that their perseverance is grounded in faith. That's why the Christophers have prepared a news note called Persevering Through Pain and Struggle. It shares stories and reflections that will help you endure challenging times by relying on the promise of God's love. To request your free copy of Persevering Through Pain and Struggle, send an email to radio@christophers.org. Or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. That's 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi, and I'm talking today with best-selling author Dean Kuntz about his novel The City, about his novel Innocence, and about the Odd Thomas series, and about the reasons he grounds all his books in an unwavering sense of hope. Now, there's a comment Grandpa Teddy makes in the book. In the beginning was the word, before all else the word, so we speak as if words matter because they do. And that's important coming from you as a writer, but to me I also see the obvious biblical reference. I have to wonder, has the Bible shaped your storytelling in terms of themes or insights into human nature?
It's been shaped by many things. It's shaped by that. It's shaped by, in my case, Catholicism. Mm-hmm. It's shaped by simply interactions with other people in the world. When I was younger, my wife would say, you know, the problem with you is you think everybody's wonderful when you first meet him, and it can take you years to see that that person is just going to stab you in the back repeatedly. And over the years, I learned she was correct. Sometimes, well, all the time, her perception of people is generous, but always more direct than mm-hmm. mine. She has always seemed to be able to see in the beginning what it takes me a while to see. But on the other hand, I think that's also one reason I love character above story. I love stories. You have to have a wonderful, gripping story in a book.
Sure.
But if you don't have characters you love, then you're not going to have a story anybody wants to bother reading. And as a consequence, I think it's interaction with people, faith. It's everything in life that leads you to have that thing you need as a writer. And when Grandpa Teddy, I'm wandering a little here, so I'll get back to your
question. Okay.
When Grandpa Teddy tells Jonah words matter, because in the beginning was the word, when Jonah, I think, says, if I remember correctly, he uses some little bit of slang or whatnot, and his grandfather instructs him, we don't talk that way in this family, mm-hmm. and words make a big difference. That was something I didn't get in my family because books weren't so important, but I think books taught me how important language was from a very young age. By the time I was 10 or 12, I just about exhausted all the young reader books in the library. And they wouldn't let you go into the adult section in those days.
Really?
Until you were 16 in my little town.
Okay.
You know? In my little town, just the title Madame Bovary would be scandalous. It would be totally misinterpreted. And so when I think I was 12, the librarian said, I'm going to make an exception in your case, and I'm going to let you into the adult section. And of course, when you got in the adult section, it wasn't anything worse than Herman Woke, or there weren't a lot of scandalous books in
yeah.
those days. And so that when Grandpa Teddy tells him that language, I think it's been very important to me that books became my escape, and books showed me the power of the word.
Right, right. Well, you also do a lot of pop culture references to movie characters. I mean, you write about Gabby Hayes, I think, in One Door Away from Heaven. You make references a lot. Did the heroes you saw in movies almost maybe in a way serve as father figures to you in a sense, in a visual sense of what you would like your father to have been like?
Probably. I haven't thought so much about that. I had an uncle who lived in the same town, my mother's sister's husband, who was a wonderful guy, my Uncle Ray, and he knew I did not have any good father-son relation. So he went out of his way to try to make that happen between me and him to a degree, and I learned a lot from him that way. But you're probably right. There was a time when the lead characters in movies were almost always admirable. And now they're either semi-fascistic superheroes or they're not very admirable at all. And I find that, and some people may think it's more sophisticated, but I find it rather sad.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's one of the strengths of your novels. I mean, the heroes, especially, say, in the Odd Thomas stories, I mean, he is an admirable character. He's got virtues, and he tries to share those with the world. He tries to live up to, instead of sinking down to others' levels, he tries to raise up the people around him and the world around him. So, no, I think that's, I think we need stories like that, Dean.
It's what civilization is based on. It's if you go back and think about history, storytelling comes at the beginning, and the storytelling shows civilizations how to be and how they should be. And it's so common to find nihilism at the center of a novel that when I get to the point where I realize it's not just the characters who believe life has no purpose, meaning, and everything is relative, but it's also the author, I put the book aside. And movies are about the same way with me. If I get to that point, I think, so what? What is the point of writing a novel or making a movie that is nihilistic, aimed at spreading nihilism and supporting the nihilism of the reader or the viewer, Because in the end, you're saying that nothing has any meaning, so therefore your movie or your novel has no meaning. And why did you spend years working on it?
Yeah, well, at least apparently they're getting paid for it, so that might be one reason.
I think you just hit on it.
I'm talking to Dean Koontz about his novel, The City. Well, one thing that can be nihilistic in storytelling and novels and stuff is witnessing characters who suffer and die. Usually that's depicted as a horrible thing, and it usually is. But I noticed in your case, death is a little bit more involved in that. And I'm guessing that something comes from your Catholic background. When you're writing characters and they have to die, how is it for you as their creator, so to speak? Because it's emotional for me as a reader. I'm not going to say who dies in The City, but, you know, there's a character, a likable character who gets killed. And what is that experience for you? How do you approach death for your characters and even just your view of it in general?
Well, you never approach it lightly, especially if it's a very appealing character. You have to approach it with seriousness. I think one of the things that is valuable in a book, and you never, like I said, the story has to absolutely demand it. You don't do it just to have an amazing twist. It just has to be essential to the fabric of the whole story, mm-hmm. and then you can do it. But one of the things I think that always guides me is, what is the aftermath and how does it affect the lives of the others in the story? And do they reach some sort of cathartic moment or some sort of breakthrough in their own understanding of their own lives? And usually that's centered around the idea of loss and how we cope with it. Because I have said in other books that death and loss of those we love is not something to embitter us, because we're already a fallen species. We're already potentially very dark. And if we didn't have loss, we would become just monsters of ego. And loss teaches us humility, basically, and teaches us about our own fragility. And there is benefit in loss, and especially if you believe that this world is only prelude to another.
Right, right. Well, does the Catholic concept of the communion of saints, does that bring you any comfort in terms of just the death in the world? Do you approach it that way for your characters? Because there does seem to be a thin line between this life and the next life in your book, especially in, say, the Odd Thomas series.
Yeah, well, an odd that's really built into the weave because of Odd's particular paranormal talent. Mm-hmm. Jonah doesn't have, in The City, doesn't have a paranormal talent, but he has fabulous talent on the piano. And Jonah's losses are more than just somebody he loves. There's other losses for Jonah in this. But this book actually brings the idea of communion of saints further probably than I've ever worked on it within a novel, because in a sense, he can see that in his own life. A surrogate father appears in this story who's an upstairs neighbor in the tenement where they live. His name mm-hmm. is Mr. Yoshioka. And this is set in the 60s, and Mr. Yoshioka's family were in Manzanar, one of the detention camps that grew up quickly after Pearl Harbor. So Jonah, between his grandfather and his grandmother and his mother and Mr. Yoshioka and some other characters that come and go in his life, essentially almost sees the communion and the saints at work in this world, I think.
Okay. Well, you dedicate the book to your mom, Florence Koontz, and also to a Mildred Stefko. Who is Mildred Stefko?
Well, this is kind of amusing. I also dedicate it at the top to my British publisher and editor, who's a very insightful woman that it's been kind of a pleasure to work with. And Joe Stefko is a rock and roll musician. I have to give you a little background on who Joe is.
Okay.
So you can know who Mildred is. But Joe is a rock and roll drummer with orange and green hair and has the whole look. And he played back in the day with Meatloaf and a number of other major acts. And for about, I don't know, 15 years, maybe longer, he's played with that old group, the Turtles.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. And they had enough hits that they still have performed, up until recently anyway, pretty regularly and all over the country. And Joe's mother was Mildred, and I had a couple of letter exchanges with her. Joe publishes limited editions, quite beautiful limited editions, and he has published a great number of mine, and it's sort of the secondary thing he does, and he's a book fanatic. So he gets to see my manuscripts first, along with my wife and my editor, because he's going to do the limited. And I got an email from him when he was reading manuscript of The City, and he said, I'm on page 30, and I had to get up and get Kleenex.
Well, that's a good sign.
And then the next email said, I'm on page 40-something, I had to get up and get Kleenex again. And then his third email said, on page 61, I just got up and got a bath towel. Well, he had a very close relationship with his mother, and she was a great lady, and this book really got to him. So I was so moved by how moved he was that I just thought, well, I should dedicate this book to my mother, and I should dedicate it to his in part. And, of course, then he just got even more overwhelmed. I think he went through several bathhouses.
Well, that's a good sign for an author to know you're having that effect on your readers.
Yeah, it almost gets no better.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to best-selling author Dean Koontz about his novel, The City. We are out of time on today's show, but Dean and I are going to keep talking and bring you more of our conversation next time. On that next episode, Dean and I are going to talk about his Odd Thomas series and how it's coming to an end with the final novel in the series called Saint Odd. He's going to give us some insight about that. He's also going to talk about his work for a charity for children with disabilities and what it's taught him about seeing beauty in the world and beauty in people that society sometimes considers outcasts because they suffer from disabilities. We're also going to talk about Dean's sense of God in the world, how he sees God everywhere through wonder and through humility and through open-mindedness, and how he thinks you don't have to belong to a certain creed in order to look at the world in that open-minded way. He's going to talk about his experience of faith, prayer, and the supernatural, and also about finding meaning and purpose and the sacredness of every moment in his life every day. Dean and I have a lot more ground to cover in next week's show, so I hope you tune in then. And in the meantime, you should pick up his book, The City, or one of his other books we're talking about, like Innocence or the Odd Thomas series. You can look for more information on his website, which is deankoontz.com. He's a wonderful author whose stories have an unwavering sense of hope and love and faith in the midst of the violence that goes on in the stories, just like in the world around us. He's grounded in the belief that in the long run, in the really long run, everything is going to be okay because God's love is on our side. Now, before we end today's show, here's another message that the Christophers would like to share with you.
In a world with millions of distractions, it's all too easy to lose sight of God in the midst of housework or homework or a hard day at the office. Yet God continues to speak to you, even in your busiest or most distracted moments. That's why the Christophers have prepared a news note called Listening When God Speaks. It shares stories about people who have learned to recognize God's voice in their lives and offers advice on how you can do the same. To request your free copy of Listening When God Speaks, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. That's 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineers for today's show are Josh Solomon and Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.